government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed, by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility.
Our responsibility, how the topic keeps arising. Today we have a treat for you. I have spent much of the last 2 days at home in bed and reading the book. The book on the table is by Stanley K. Ridgely, PhD. It's called Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities. And Dr. Ridgely is a PhD in clinical full help. You know, keep having to be reminded that at 67, I probably ought to put my glasses on. Okay. At full professor of management at Drexel University's Laveau College of Business. He has also studied in Moscow State University at the Institut de Gestion Sociale in Paris. And he is a former military intelligence officer who served in West Berlin and near the Czech-German border, where he received the George S. Patton Award for Leadership from the 7th Army NCO Academy. It is a joy, a pleasure, and an honor to welcome Professor Stanley Ridgely. How do you prefer to be addressed, sir?
I tell you what, Charles, you can call me Stan. How about that?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I would address you by your military rank, your professor, Dr. Ridgely, or Stan. Whatever you want. My dad would never abide by me calling somebody by other than their honorific if they didn't say so first. So, good. Welcome.
We can dispose of that. Just call me Stan. We're all friends here.
Good. I like it. And the same is true of me. I'm just Charles. Let's see. Hang on a second here. Gotta uncover the notes I made for the questions. On Foundation, were you interested in all the topics in Brutal Minds before your stint in Army Intelligence? Or did that sort of, was that somewhat of the genus of your interest in the topics in Brutal Minds?
Well, the topics in Brutal Minds came to the top of mind during my research for another book that I was working on, The Influence of Marxism and Freirean Politics in the Business School. And I went where the bibliographic trail led me, only to discover by tugging on the tapestry of the liberal mindset in the university, to discover this amazing bureaucracy, this bureaucratic engine of indoctrination that exists on the campus. Most people think that they already know about this and they know what it consists of, and they really don't. This is completely new over the last 20 years. And so I went in the direction that my research led me. My military intelligence pedigree certainly helps with asking the right questions and pursuing the questions until the answer is, you know, makes itself manifest. So I hope that answers your question there.
It does. This goes really, the tendrils of this go back to the Frankfurt School, do they not?
Yeah, they certainly do. You know, a lot of people probably should. It's not the best reading in the world, this critical theory that's generated by the Frankfurt School, but it is Marxism. It's neo-Marxism, as they used to call it. And it's the genesis of a lot of the nonsense and absurdities we see in the university today and in society at large. It is neo-Marxism. Some of the big personalities were Theodore Adorno and Herbert Marcuse from 1968, Max Horkheimer, and these are people that are not, you know, household words to Americans, but certainly a knowledge of the Frankfurt School and what it has done to corrupt our institutions in this country is absolutely mandatory. It's necessary to understand the nature of the threat. It is indeed Marxist.
Yep. It just seems to keep rebranding itself every 20 to 25
yeah.
years, and it's just a new casing for the same excrement. But anyway, what is so-called anti-
100%.
Yeah.
Agree with 100% with that, Charles.
What is so-called anti-racist pedagogy?
Well, anti-racist pedagogy, and I say yes, properly so-called, is that there's big A anti-racism and there's little A anti-racism. I think that little A anti-racism is basically the idea that you shouldn't be, you should work to against racism, you know, blatant, obvious, overt racism in the society and all its manifestations. And I think most good people, people of goodwill, agree with that. Big A anti-racism, as in anti-racist pedagogy, is a whole system of instruction that is grounded in critical race theory, and it is grounded in the notion that all white people are racist, and this condition cannot be fixed. It basically views society as a binary construct. I'm going to use the word Manichaean. Mm-hmm. A lot of people can relate to that. It's a binary construct where people fall into one of two categories, and that's it. There are oppressors, and there are oppressed. There's exploiters, and there are exploited. There's evil, and then there's good. And you're in one category or the other. Ibram Kendi makes a point of this, and he is hailed as some sort of a messiah for the anti-racism crew. But the fact is, it's very primitive ideology that he espouses in his book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. He has the potential to be a reasonable scholar. I've read his book, Stamped from the Beginning. It's fairly good. It looks at the early ideas early racist ideas in American history. But his How to Be an Anti-Racist is just balderdash. I'll use an acceptable word, twaddle, in the sense that he divides it into everyone into these two categories. It's a very primitive, goes back to the religious cleric Mani from 2,000 years ago, not quite 2,000 years ago, where everyone is in either a category of good or evil, and there's no in between, there's no nuance, there's no shades of gray. And Ibram Kendi tells us exactly how you can, you know, fit into one of these two categories, and that you have to choose. And this is absurd. It's absurd on its face. It's worked its way into the university, where this type of balderdash and pseudo scientific nonsense was expunged, you know, more than 300 years ago, and it's making its way back in. So anti-racist pedagogy is based on that notion that there is good and there's evil, there are oppressors and oppressed. This is straight out of the Marxist textbook. And we should recognize that.
Yeah, it's the dialectic of struggle, and that there always has to be a good and evil and somebody to be struggled against. Otherwise, you can't stir people up if you don't get them mad.
Yeah. You mentioned, Charles, the idea that Marxism keeps coming back rebranded. And there's a reason for that. There are folks on the left have what they call a mindset, and they call it left melancholy. And this is the wistful feeling that they have, that comes upon them when they see socialism and Marxism and communism fail in yet another country. They see the failure, and it gives them a wistful sense of nostalgia and the idea that the dream has failed yet again. So they maintain their faith in the face of facts that you and I see and say, well, this thing failed. It's a miserable, oppressive ideology, and that's why it failed. It doesn't work. It doesn't work to make people's lives better. It doesn't make, you know, doesn't make the human condition better. And yet these people, these left-wingers, a fellow by the name of Enzo Traverso wrote a book called Left Melancholy. He tells all about this. This is something that is current amongst them, but we don't really hear it in the public discourse, I think, for obvious reasons. But this is one reason why Marxism keeps coming back under a new label.
Is he still alive?
Who's this?
The author you just mentioned?
Enzo Traverso, I couldn't say.
Hmm. Because a lot of times during these interviews, I find good leads to show bookings. It's producing on the hoof, I call it. But I'll Google it.
I don't know. Go ahead and Google that up. I don't think he'd be a good.
Not while you're on the air with me right now. I'm not going to do anything distracting that. So who are those that are of brutal mind, so to speak? Who are they?
I can give you, first of all, I give the category, then I can give you some names. The fact is, brutal minds are those people who want to engage in a kind of brainwashing thought reform on the college campus designed to change people's belief system. That's what brainwashing is all about. It's not a contrived word. It's not been a word that is – it's not a popularized type of valorization of thought reform. It actually exists. It appears in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, Edition 5, and it can cause psychological damage. It is the imposition of a psychological manipulation and behavior modification program on a targeted population, usually students in this case, designed to do what? Designed to change their belief system. It occurs in three stages. It is unfreezing, changing the belief system, and then refreezing the new belief system. And the people who engage in this, I call them brutal minds, because anyone who would do this sort of thing and do it without apology and celebrate it and publish books and articles on how well they're doing it really doesn't need to be on the university campus. They probably need to be facing a judge somewhere to answer for their sins. I'll give you some names. Cheryl Matias at the University of Kentucky, George Yancey at Emory University, Johnny E. Williams at Trinity University, Ricky Lee Allen at New Mexico. Probably Zeus Leonardo is a good one. He is at, I believe, is at Berkeley. These are the brutal minds. They're the ones. And Sherry K. Watt, she's one of the worst. Sherry K. Watt at the University of Iowa. And Marianne Adams, Leanne Bell. These are people whose books I read. I have over 250 of their books that I buy them. I read them as they come out to maintain my currency and fluency in their ideas and what it is they're saying on the campus. Let me give you another name and where she is. Her name is Lisa Spanierman. She's at Arizona State University. She's a psychologist. She is a position of administration now. She's a dean. And she has actually written an article that is absolutely amazing in the sense that here's what she says in the article. She believes, and she's a psychologist, that there are certain techniques that can be used in the classroom against white males. This is her terminology. Against white males that can make them feel guilt about most any instance, experience that they've had nothing to do with. They can be made to feel guilt over most anything if the proper stimuli is applied. Once they have been, this fake guilt has been generated, the students are more likely to be and more susceptible to a message that will get them working for a, quote, social justice program, working for social justice, working for this anti-racist project that we talked about. So here is a faculty member, a psychologist, an administrator calling for the use of psychological techniques in the classroom to generate false guilt so as to manipulate the student's mindset to get them working for social justice, however you want to define that. Usually it's a socialist left-wing cause of some sort. So this is a perfect example of brainwashing, utilizing psychological manipulation and behavior modification techniques to change a person's belief system. This is really not speculation. You know?
You're a college professor, and you've been so for some time. Is there a general canon of ethics for college professors? And if there is, does her statement at ASU, does that violate the canon of college professor ethics?
I would say it violates her the ethics that she has as a psychologist to utilize psychological techniques against people without for informed consent. Ethics aside, there's federal law that applies to this type of psychological experimentation. You cannot engage in this type of psychological manipulation and experimentation on people without their consent. You have to get their in what's called informed consent. The Office of Research of Human Research Protections, the Federal Office of Human Office of Human Research Protections covers this. The Institutional Review Board at the university covers this. The Belmont's statement, the Belmont Report, 1979 covers this. The Nuremberg laws that came out of the medical experimentation by Mengele
right.
and others.
Between 49 and 45, the trials, yeah.
Yeah. The Nuremberg laws all apply to this, and that if this, you don't have to accept this sort of thing, but certainly a in this case, a psychologist in the classroom and is that is doing this, and moreover writing articles that advocates this. I have the article, I put it on my website, I've got the book in which it appears right here. So this is 2023 when the article appears. We're not talking about ancient history.
Yeah.
And this person is still at Arizona State. Now, as far as your question, the code of ethics. Now, Max Weber, who was the founder of sociology, God bless him, he was a good one, okay?
Stan, can we hold this because we're late on a break?
Yeah.
Can we do that? We'll
sure.
start out with code of ethics as soon as we hit the other side of the break in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios at KPOI, 520-790-2040. It's a brilliant piece of work. It's called Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in our Universities by Stanley K. Ridgely. And we'll be back after this.
Swap shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track. Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the swap shop. Let's listen.
Never give up on the power of the swap shop.
Who knows? And I mean, somebody could have had a whole bunch of old pagers laying around, and they called the swap shop and said, "Can we buy them? We got an order for some pagers. We just need to work on them a little bit first."
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Mark Levin. Liberty Watch on KVOI is dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master. Sounds like Charles has been reading my books. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Well, I've got friends in safe spaces. If you don't go with us, then you must be racist. That's our catchphrase. Where's my come on in and let's get cozy. Showing off participation trophies, watching CNN. Sage faces.
Welcome back to Liberty Watch with Professor Stan Ridgely, who's professor of political science, and he has written a number of books. One of them is Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities. And the question we had before the break was, what about ethics? What about rules of conduct for people at the university level, especially people like a dean?
Well, I would say that I look to Max Weber for my own ethical guidance. Max Weber is one of the founders of sociology in the last century, who wrote a famous essay called Science as a Vocation, in which he advocated value neutrality in the classroom, where the professor tries and strives mightily to achieve objectivity, recognizing, of course, that pure objectivity is the ideal that you can never achieve. But the idea that the professor should not use the captive audience and his own authority to propound his personal political viewpoints. That's the fundamental value-free classroom. Now, that has been challenged. That's been challenged by the Marxists, of course. I give you Frederick Jameson, who was a prominent Marxist theorist who was at Duke University when I was a graduate student there. And he basically said that the purpose of the university is not knowledge creation and transmission to the next generation, but rather it is a crucible of combat. It is a place where we should train the next generation of Marxists for the struggles of the future. That's a very different view of the university as we have traditionally understood it. And I think that those on the left have kept that kind of view or that viewpoint pretty much under wraps, preferring to allow parents and alumni to conceive of the university as the way that they always thought it was. And it's really not this neutral, I would say, arena where ideas, the marketplace of ideas, where ideas can combat with each other and the best idea wins. That's not the way it is now.
The Russians have a word for that. They call it maskarovka.
Yeah, maskarovka. Mm-hmm. I was a Russian linguist for a while, and that's absolutely true. Dezinformatsiya is
mm-hmm.
another one.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And tell us about Susieng Kai Tsao, or ideological remodeling.
Susieng Kai Tsao. That's the Chinese version of this, which is means thought reform. It's the idea that you can take a person and you can run them through a program on a kind of a conveyor belt to remold their thought processes. Now, a kind of a crude version of that you can see in the 1962 film called Manchurian Candidate,
mm-hmm.
With Frank Sinatra. It's a great film. But that kind of gave people a kind of a stereotypical view of, you know, strobe lights and electrodes and everything else and controlling their minds. And it's much more subtle than that. The Chinese were very good at doing this sort of thing. They got it from the United States. Susieng Kai Tsao, or brainwashing, I should say, thought reform, originated with a fellow by the name of Kurt Lewin in the 1940s at MIT. He was a social psychologist, and he is known as the father of the encounter group. A nice tidbit of information for the audience. The father of the encounter group is Kurt Lewin. He believed you could change the mindset, the belief system of criminals, and prevent them from, you know, being criminals and sliding back into lifestyle, criminal lifestyle. He came up with a three-stage program of brainwashing called unfreezing the belief system, changing it, and then refreezing the belief system. Now, today's the Chinese took that and utilized that to do this, to apply it to in a very brutal manner to political prisoners, to Western intellectuals that they had as prisoners, to their own intellectuals in the 1950s and on into the 60s, and certainly 1966 to 1976 in the Great Cultural Revolution under Mao Zedong.
Mm-hmm.
And where the idea was this: rather than kill your opponent, as the Soviets were so very good at doing, you know, with the bullet to the back of the head and the Lubyanka, the communist Chinese believed that you could change people's belief system and turn your enemies into your allies. And it was a very brutal system. It's depressing reading about what they would do to these folks. Writing confession after confession after confession, torture, imprisonment, constant bombardment by a group of people who had already been converted or people who were ideologues, constantly bombarding day in and day out in a prison cell while the prisoner was bound. And this is the kind of thing that we don't do here in the States. But this was how the method was applied in communist China, still being applied in the, you know, concentration camps that contain the Uyghur population. Now, back to Kurt Lewin, he came up with the fact, if you ever wanted to know who coined the term re-education, which is kind of an unsavory word, right? He's the guy who coined that. And it was not an unsavory connotation to it when he coined it, until finally the left began to realize that we can't keep calling this re-education, as in re-education camp. We have to call it something else. So they called it transformative education, and they use that even today. The Chinese, meanwhile, the communist Chinese, meanwhile, decided to change theirs from re-education to education for transformation. So you can see the parallels here.
Mm.
And so nowadays, the left on the campuses, they talk about transformative education. They're transforming a person from their belief system to one that is grounded in, say, critical consciousness or Marxian critical consciousness. They want to rid a person of what is called false consciousness. I think we're both very familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that means bringing a person along to critical consciousness. That's the term that they actually use. The head of our psychology, or rather our philosophy department, uses this, says, I have critical consciousness. And he's trying to elevate people's consciousness, to open their eyes, to peer into the contradictions of society, see the relationships of power and privilege. And basically critical consciousness means that you believe in and accept the neo-Marxist way of thought and the perception of the world as it exists. Basically, this binary of oppressors and oppressed, of evil and good, of exploiters and exploited.
It always boils.
Charles, I was going to say, Charles, you and I have false consciousness, and that's all it means is that we haven't emerged to critical consciousness. It's kind of a tautology, circular argument.
Well, here's to circular arguments. And here's to the resistance to the tautology. I mean, if we raise people that are strong enough, if we raise people that are strong enough, Stan, to resist this, what is the result? I mean, when a professor says something in college and you know, tries to put this malarkey over on somebody, can we raise people that are strong enough to go, that's not true?
Well, I tell you, Charles, I don't want to backtrack on this. I think you read Brutal Minds,
yeah.
And I made the distinction between what's going on in the classroom,
yeah, versus
and what's
outside,
going on outside,
yeah,
the classroom.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, not you have this group of people who were in the faculty, and that group is very small. These folks, most faculty that I know, left or right, you know, they're good people. They just do their job. They're really interested in research and teaching. Teaching for me is like my primary activity, but for them, they just, you know, teach the subject matter. A very small minority, usually outside their bailiwick, as they teach out, they are commenting outside their bailiwick. They're usually English faculty or sociology faculty, liberal arts type literature professors. They like to talk about politics and inject that into the classroom. Students can pretty much let that wash over them. That's, you know, I'm out of here kind of thing. But the big problem is the bureaucracy outside the classroom, which are consciously engaged in a brainwash program called the co-curriculum. These are student affairs people, and they've gone largely unremarked upon, largely invisible, anonymous. And yet the bureaucracy is huge. It has students, they face students 24/7 in some cases in the dorms, and they run what is called a co-curriculum. It's a fake curriculum, a fake lineup of classes, seminars, in which this brainwashing we've been talking about is run without restriction. And they call these seminars, I'm going to give you an example so that students, when they see this sort of thing, can understand what they're engaged in. And I'll tell you why students are can be so susceptible to this. The names of these things are called, you know, are brave spaces, safe spaces, courageous conversations, difficult dialogues. These are seminars that are run by non-faculty for the most part. They're run by DEI offices. They are run by off-campus DEI consultants who are brought onto the campus, at a hefty price tag. And they run these conferences. Intergroup dialogues is another. Racial caucuses is another. These are events or activities that are unsupervised by any faculty member. They are run by non-faculty, usually people who really, you know, want to be faculty, who call themselves college educators. Student affairs is rife with this type of person. And one of the off-campus groups that is called ACPA, or the Association for Student College Professionals, Student Affairs Professionals, they have as their motto, boldly transforming higher education. And they have bought into this whole left-wing, radical, anti-racist pedagogy thing we've been talking about.
Borrowing a little from Star Trek, boldly go.
Yeah, boldly transforming higher education. No one asks these people to transform higher education. Who the hell are they? They're not faculty. They're functionaries, ancillary support staff, usually enrollment clerks. I've seen on my own campus that people running reading seminars on White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. Is a human lactation specialist and a poet clerk were running the
human lactation specialist.
Yes, a human lactation specialist and a poet clerk. I'm not even going to speculate, Charles.
Well, I gotta tell you, I went to my favorite coffee shop in Sedona last year, and I said, I want, make me some unusual drink, and because I'm here on vacation, just make me something unusual. And they said, are you particular about your milk? I said, oh no, I don't lactate. So, all right, stand by. Yeah, we got a break coming up here, so. With Professor Stan Ridgely of the excellent book, Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
I wanted to give a big shout out to Arizona Tree. I noticed a saguaro, and it was going to fall right on my well. The biggest darn blew off, and it lost its balance.
Well, so, we do support the right of cactus to keep and bear arms.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
Hi, it's Dennis Prager. Liberty Watch is dedicated to the notion that government remain servant, not master. Goes very well with my concept of E Pluribus Unum, liberty, and in God we trust. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
She, a guy who thinks he's a girl. He, the other way around.
What?
Don't question it. They is for non-binary. He or she would really get them down. It's literal violence. Z, a neutral word like Zim. Sam, as natural as Faye.
Her,
someone who is Purcell. And that brings us back to... Stop it.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch. A little bit of levity in the break music. And were you able to hear that down the phone line, Stan?
Oh, yeah. Good music. I enjoy the epic fade-out music as well. Powerful. Love it.
Thank you. The question – oh, yes, that's from Pirates of the Caribbean. The question, though, is – it's a little bit off the topic we were discussing, but does parody have a place in destroying DEI brutal minds?
Does what have a say,
parody?
Say that again for me.
Parody.
Not parody, but parody.
No. You think too literally, Stan. You're definitely a PhD. You think too literally.
So parody, meaning
making fun of them.
So, well, certainly, I know that you're probably familiar with Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals.
Yes. Read it many times.
Yeah. And one of his rules is ridicule is a wonderful weapon.
Yes.
And it's very hard to respond to it. And so I'm a big believer in that. And so I think that parody is wonderful in the sense that parody carries a certain amount of truth with it for it to be an effective parody. And whenever you begin to if you're not able to distinguish between parody and what's actually happening, that's whenever people slap their foreheads and go, wow, this is what's going on. I thought it was a parody. And the fact is, I will tell you, Charles, that I've had this experience very recently where I will present material that is – I'm working on my next book, and the material comes from my next book. The material off of the websites of left-wing organizations and consultancies that are teaching DEI and doing DEI training on the college campuses. And I'm getting stuff off of University of Michigan website, University of Wisconsin website, and I simply print that. And I had one woman said, what is the source of this? Where is this from? What's the source of this? Quit publishing anti-black propaganda. And I said, you're just catering to the MAGA crowd. I said, excuse me, the source is the National Museum for African American History and Culture.
Did she respond?
That's the source. No, of course not. They never do. They check it out. And I gave her a link to show her that this is where the material came from. And another fellow says, this is BS and lies. I said, what's BS and lies? It's simply a reprint of what DEI folks at University of Michigan, Boston University, the National Education Foundation, this is what they teach students in this anti-racism pedagogy in the DEI sessions. This is what they're doing. This is it. It came off of their website, and they're attacking the material, attacking me, for the material that's come off the DEI. This is what happens whenever you have people who are so devoted to a notion or an idea or a theme or an ethos, they become cult members. They become cult-like, that they refuse to believe the evidence of their own eyes, their own ears, and what they actually see and read. They refuse to believe it. They'd rather believe the conception in their own mind, yeah.
Cognitive dissonance.
Yes, they can't accept it.
Right. Tell us about the PIE model for indoctrination.
Oh, that's by Sherry K. Watt. I knew you were going to ask me about that. I got the book right here. She's supposedly a psychologist at the University of Iowa. She's big time in DEI, and she's gotten all of these awards. Well, it's called the Privileged Identity Exploration Model, PIE. And in this model, she actually says up front, and I quote her extensively, that she wants to attack a person's belief system in her classes So to create a sense of intellectual vertigo, to destabilize the sense of self of a person. This is what she says. And this is exactly what the idea of brainwashing does. Mm-hmm. The Chinese are very good at this. You basically disrupt a person's sense of self, who they are, who they believe themselves to be, their relationship with their parents, with their friends. You want to disrupt this with destabilizing stimuli. That's the words that she uses. Now, I don't know of anyone who wants to take a class where the professor is going to be attacking them and trying to destabilize their sense of self. Again, this person does not accede to the regulations of informed consent, telling students, okay, by the way, I'm going to be engaging in well-known brainwashing techniques, destabilizing the sense of self. Can you please sign this informed consent that I told you exactly what we're going to be doing? No, she doesn't do that. No one does that. Lisa Spanning in ASU doesn't do that. And all it's going to take is someone to bring a lawsuit against these folks, and I certainly hope they do, to get them to back off of this type of brainwashing. That's the privileged identity exploration model. Right? She says it's based on the work of Sigmund Freud, but she made a mistake in her own book.
It's Anna Freud.
It's Anna Freud, yeah. Yes, it's Anna Freud. I said, well, this date seems awfully late for Sigmund Freud. And turns out it's his daughter, Anna. And so that's the kind of precision we can expect from these DEI folks.
Has anybody from the Arizona legislature reached out to you at all?
Well, I have, no, not at all. I have there's a writer, a journalist in Arizona named Rachel Alexander, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I made her aware of this, and she wrote an expose on Lisa Spanierman.
She with the Arizona Daily Independent?
I'm not sure. I don't know if she's freelance or not, but she wrote a very good article on Lisa Spanierman exposing this. And I don't know what the results are. No, the answer to your question is no one has reached out to me on this. I have an article on my website, brutalminds.com. You can go there and you can type in Lisa Spanierman. And it takes you to the article that I wrote, my own article I wrote, and it includes the PDF of her article where you can read for yourself. It's not something I'm going to say, hey, believe me when I say that she's doing this manipulation. No, her article is there, and you can read it for yourself, and you can see for yourself where she says we're going to attack the sensibilities of white males. We're going to make them feel guilty about something they had nothing to do with, and then we're going to use that guilt to recruit them into working for social justice. This is all right there in the article. But people go, man, this is what they, oh, these are lies. This is BS, these are lies. And I said, well, what do you do with a person who says that when they look at the
evidence?
Took
it off your website. Yeah.
Well, sorry?
Took it off your website. It's only a lie if you lied.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the article. What do you think of that? And they won't refuse to acknowledge that. But I encourage people to, if they want to see for themselves, and I substantiate all of this on my website, brutalminds.com, so that you can see for yourself. And you don't have to believe me.
Why hasn't anyone tried to sue one of these college professors for psychological abuse?
I have no idea. I really don't. I think that a lot of it's lack of information, a lack of people don't want to get involved in this. I just want to keep my head to students. I want to keep my head down, get a decent grade, and get the heck out of here. All it's going to take is one student who says, I'm not putting up with this stuff. Well, and I think a lot of this stuff is settled out of court. I got one student who told me, my dad has told me if anyone tries to get me to go into one of these star chamber sessions on a college campus with no representation, he says, you let me know, and we're going to have a lawyer there by your side, lickety split. So there is a kind of a
seems to me. That in this day of electronic gadgetry, that somebody mm-hmm. would be recording these classes and publishing them on the internet and pointing yeah. out exactly what people are saying and doing. I mean, it's not that difficult today to put an app on your phone to record something like that.
Yeah, I will tell you the problem with suing universities is that I've discovered this, is that they are heavily insured, So even the Oberlin College that was told by a judge they had to pay $36 million to the Gibson Bakery in a celebrated case. I think the ruling came down in 2023. Paid $36 million for supporting the harassment of this bakery that the university, the Oberlin College, was insured up to $50 million, so they didn't have to pay a cent. But the problem with that, they found out, is the two insurance companies, I think it was Livingston and United Educators, refused to pay. And this threw Oberlin to a tizzy. So I think that the fact that they're backstopped with lots and lots of money and insurance, that these general counsels for most colleges and universities don't really care whether you sue them or not. And they'll usually try to settle. I know several people who are working on lawsuits right now, and they usually will make the settlement really lucrative along with a non-disclosure agreement, and then that's how they manage to survive. And even if they are successfully sued, most people don't have the stomach to go through several years of litigation. The case that I just mentioned, Gibson's Bakery, started in 2016, and the owner of the bakery and his son both died before they got the money. And so it was their heirs.
It's like Masterpiece Bakers. That case took 6 or 7 years, too, against Colorado.
Yeah.
I wonder what would happen in the classroom of Professor Cheryl Mathias or someone like her if a student thanked her for reaffirming his power and told her how great it made him feel. She said, "You have white privilege." He says, "That's," and the kid were to say, "That's great. Thanks for telling me. I knew there was a reason I felt so powerful. Thank you." What would that do? What would happen?
I will tell you this. This professor would probably knock him down a half or an entire grade for that, not being responsive. They label students like that you just described. They have a word for that. It's resistance. Resistors.
Right.
Student resistance. These are, and they basically have set aside extra time for those people. And they mark it as a failure on their part, and they'll simply count up the people they've managed to brainwash. When I say brainwash, I'm talking about the kind of the things the Moonies do. Here is on the college campus, we talk about inclusion and belonging. Well, the Moonies have their own mantra, and that is peace and unity. Now, neither peace and unity nor inclusion and belonging, there's anything inherently bad about that sort of thing. It's what it covers up, the maskarovka that you talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. That is really what's noxious about it. And so the Moonies have a system whereby they take people out from the city into to the countryside for their weekend retreats. When the people get off the bus, they have body language experts internal to the organization pick out the people who are receptive and susceptible to recruitment. They have these wide eyes looking all around. Oh, we're so great to be here. They usher them right on in. Then you got the streetwise type cocking an eyebrow, say, "What the hell's going on here?" Those people are shunted off to the side, put back on the bus, and sent back to the city. Mm. And that way, you kind of get rid of the resistors up front.
Right.
So there's no one disrupting the
I refer to it as a Leatherman culture. People who carry some form of a multi-tool, whether it's Leatherman or something else, are self-sufficient, and they can survive anywhere with just a Leatherman tool. And people who have that kind of confidence and know what to do, especially people who've been through scouting before it got perverted, have a much stronger moral gyroscope against stuff like that. Or do you find otherwise?
Let me tell you, Charles, that is absolutely essential. I find that they are definitely survivors and hard nuts to crack for these folks. One of the problems that we run into, and I want to give this kind of a piece of advice. I list red flags and tells of what these people are trying to do on the campuses. But one piece of advice I would give a young person is don't give them your trust.
Right.
Okay, because even the person with the tool and is self-sufficient and is morally grounded can find themselves on the short end of the stick because they are fooled by these people who are running a fake curriculum, the co-curriculum. They're fake instructors, and their number one thing they want to do is to gain trust. I mean, I'm looking at one of their manuals right here. They actually have manuals for brainwashing. Here's one called Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice by Marianne Adams, Leanne Bell, and Pat Griffin, where they say what we want to do in this first stage, the stage of unfreezing, is to gain their trust. Make yourself vulnerable. They want these people to self-disclose. Why is that? because they want to gain information on you and that they can then use during the next phase against you. This is what communists do when they're getting people to make confessions and write histories about themselves and turn in their co-conspirators and to write again and again and again. I've listed the three stages as unfreezing, changing, and refreezing. Well, our own brainwashers here have different names. One, the first phase is called defending. The second phase is surrendering. The third phase is transformation or transforming. These are the phases they want to run you through. And if you don't watch out, because no one's going to say, Charles, hey, come on in here, Charles. We're going to run a brainwashing session on you here. And we're going to change your belief system. No one's going to say that.
No, they're not.
This is exactly what they say in the literature. I'm looking at this book right now, page 49.
Stan, hold on. Sure. We're up on our break, and we'll be right back after this.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country. And Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
And welcome back. Short segment here with Professor Stan Ridgely of the book Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities. It's very, very good. I've read the whole thing, including, in fact, the end notes. Are the racialist training materials that you've been talking about available anywhere online?
Certainly. You can go to the University of Michigan the website. You can go to University of Wisconsin, Madison website. Boston College website, NEA. You can look at, I would suggest that someone do a search on white supremacy culture list, and you will find an entire, you know, page after page after page where this fake white supremacy culture list, which was kind of fabricated by Tema Okun back in 1999 and has achieved a life of its own. And it's used, Duke Medical School uses it. It's basically a fake list of something that, you know, someone is basically having trouble achieving success and blames someone else for their lack of success and calls it a white supremacy behavior. It's bizarre. And you can find that. You can go to drworks.com, and this is where the source code for the white supremacy culture list. This is the list that I printed and gave to the person who accused me of publishing anti-black propaganda when it's something that came right off of the National Museum of African American History and Culture website. Rather, I should say, off their website. So, yeah, the stuff is available everywhere.
It seems like it's not universally known that all this stuff is going on, and it's right here under our noses. I have a theory.
Charles, let me tell you.
Sure.
Here's what people say. You know, they think, well, DEI, it's great, it's wonderful. Here's the standard platitudes. Well, it's teaching about race. It's teaching about slavery. It's creating a level playing field. Now, these are all – that would be like me saying, well, you know, that motherhood is grand. We all love our mothers. And then I agree with that. I said, well, let's have a program on motherhood. And then you find out that the program on motherhood is basically something I put up by Planned Parenthood. That it has nothing to do with motherhood, as a denying motherhood, that kind of thing. And so basically the implementation of this, we have to get past this, as you said, the maskarovka, and look at what's actually happening. But when people see this, they simply do not believe it.
They can't accept it. All right, hang on for just a moment. AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. I'm going to bypass the Open to America Armed and Free, go right into the America Armed and Free Hour, continuing with this guest. Stan Ridgely has said he's available, so I'm going to take him at his word. I have a theory that what people call white privilege is actually American privilege, that anyone who gets a high school diploma, mm-hmm. stays away from drugs and excessive alcohol, works, spends less than he makes, and has no children out of wedlock, has privilege, in quotes. What do you think of my theory? Mm-hmm.
I think it's great, sir. I think it makes perfect sense. It's one of those things where people like to say, well, if someone is successful in their life, well, that must be an example of privilege. And if someone has failed in their life, well, they didn't take advantage of their white privilege. That is basically pseudoscience. That's how pseudoscience works. That's how the ad hoc justification or rescue hypothesis works. You get a cosmic explanation like anti-racism or white privilege. Everything is explained in terms of this tiny, cramped little system. And so it does not admit any possibility for disconfirmation of your theory of, say, white privilege. That originated, by the way, in 1989 with Peggy McIntosh when she wrote this famous essay called, you know, The Invisible Knapsack of Privilege. Basically, it's amazing where she asks a series of, like, 50 questions where if you answer yes to the questions, it means you have privilege. And I said, you know what, this is such BS with regard to social science. She's not a research scientist as she builds herself. She has a literature and a PhD in comparative literature on the poetry of Emily Dickinson. And she's going to lecture us on something that's white privilege. Well, I can create, and I have created, you'll go to my website and look at it, the what I call the paranoia walk. And you have white, you have paranoia. And I've asked a series of leading questions, and if you answer yes to those questions, then it means you're paranoid. Mm-hmm. It's that's exactly the level that we find this so-called privilege. It's basically, these are things that I want to be successful too, but I just don't want to do what it takes to become successful. Mm. If you want to find an example of what I talk about in my classes, I talk about Frederick Douglass and his most famous speech, Self-Made Men. Mm-hmm. He gave this speech. He gave the speech over a period of 35 years, I believe, more times than any other speech. And I found that you will not find this speech in the National Museum for African American History and Culture. You will find other pieces by him. You know, what is the 4th of July to a slave? You'll find that.
Yeah.
But you will not find his commitment to self-help and work. And the magical power of sweat equity. That's an amazing essay I make available to my students, but you will not find it because ideologues have taken over that university and instead published lists like the one I told you about earlier. So, yeah.
The Self-Made Man by Frederick Douglass. Let's see how fast.
Yes.
Yep, comes right up on Google. We use Google here. I use DuckDuckGo. It comes up first when you search that.
Yeah.
It is good. What do you think Trump's recent actions will on DEI will have on this issue?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I'm writing a book on that coming out next month, and I'm incorporating his latest actions this past week. Have been absolutely phenomenal. He is returning us to American founding principles. I call it the Justice Agenda, where he has banned DEI in the government, and he is trying to ban DEI in higher institutions outside the government, saying that if you receive federal dollars, then you will adhere to American U.S. Civil rights law. This is the battle that Hillsdale College has waged for many, many years. The idea that you accept federal dollars, you have to accept federal diktat. Well, this is basically using it against folks who have decided to implement these racialist, I call it the big con game. This DEI program is in the universities. If you're going to receive federal dollars, you can't run this DEI program. You're going to have to end it. Or you'll end one or the other. You'll end the federal dollars or you'll end the program. And I think that that's going to have an incredible impact on what we see in the coming weeks and months as this whole thing unspools. Incredible. I've read both executive orders. I got them right here on my desk, printed out, where I can you know, annotate on them, and they're absolutely fabulous. Well done. Well done, Mr. President.
Last time he tried that, though, he didn't do well in the courts with enforcing his executive orders. I just wonder what's going to happen, especially when it comes to enforcing executive orders about withholding federal funding. But he wasn't successful in the courts in blocking funds from states who wouldn't comply. Well, I just wonder if they got a better strategy going.
Well, what's better is the fact that since that time in 2023, I believe it was, we've had the Supreme Court decision that handed down, that rejected Harvard and UNC Chapel Hill's admissions policies. It was a lawsuit won by Students for Fair Admissions, which found that both universities were discriminating against Asian applicants.
Right.
Significantly.
It reminds me of the 1978 Bakke decision where they were discriminating against a white guy, and he won that. He just recently passed away. Tell us about ACPA and NASPA.
Those are two off-campus professional associations. This is where the ideology is sourced. It is propounded to the membership. The ACPA has a membership of around 8,000. The NASP, the NASPA, has a membership of around 15,000. Who are these people? These are all 100% student affairs professionals or student affairs, you know, clerks, enrollment managers, dorm room managers who believe themselves to be college educators. These are the ones who run the co-curriculum I mentioned earlier. They go to these conferences. They read their books. They read articles in their journals. And this is where they learn how to run what is called the, well, the co-curricular approach, utilizing the curricular model, where they take the curricular model that we use in the faculty, and we and they use that to impose this para-curriculum right alongside the curriculum that's fake. And some colleges and universities even give transcripts for this fake curriculum. I give you an example. St. John's University and Westchester University provide transcripts. It's absurd. There's no real demand. There's no disciplinary rigor to it. It's just all fake. And it's disguised to look like the curriculum so students don't know the difference and perhaps so parents don't know the difference. And so that is what is happening on the campuses. And with regard to these folks and ACPA and NASPA, another group is NACADA, the National Organization for Academic Advisors. Now, you're thinking to yourself, well, what would they have to do with anything? Well, they believe they have a social justice agenda as well. And they believe that they should use their face time with students to introduce students to social justice causes. How do I know this? How do I know all of this? Well, I'm a member of ACPA. I'm a member of NASPA, and I'm a member of NACADA. And I also happen to be a member of the National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education. And so I read their journals. I will look at their back channel communications and chat groups. I firmly believe that if you're going to do an article or a book on one of these groups, you have to know them inside and out. And that's what I've done. And that's
Are there any non-disclosure agreements on your membership?
No, of course not. Why would they want to do that? They're lucky to have members, you know. They have a lot of ideologues. They have a lot of ideologues who are true believers and who believe that they're there. They go to the conferences and they rub each other, rub elbows, and they bring the message back to their university or their college. And they're basically, and their literature says this, they're basically undermining and working as saboteurs against the college's mission. They're doing what they're not supposed to do. They're doing what they're not hired to do. They're engaging in extracurricular sabotage of the university. They say this. They don't say I'm engaged in extracurricular sabotage. What they say is, here's how we can get around the rules that prohibit us from doing X, Y, and Z.
You know who you need to get in touch with is James O'Keefe of O'Keefe Media Group, formerly of Veritas.
Oh, yeah.
Project Veritas. He was the founder of Project Veritas. Hang on just a second.
Sure.
And I think if you got him to go into one of these meetings with a camera, or if you got him to join one of these organizations and record it and then have some conversations with people, it could be stunning what they could come up with. Kind of like what he did to Planned Parenthood when they were they were teaching them how to record get 14-year-old hookers to work in brothels. And when he got them to tell them how to do that, oh my God, that was hysterical.
Well, you know, people say that the National Association for Diversity Officers in Higher Education, there are about 2,000 members in that group, and an expensive membership, and I have access to that website as well. The fact is that, you know, well, these people can't be all that radical. So, well, I'm telling you, at their last meeting last year, I think it was a conference last year, they had Ijeoma Ulua was their keynote speaker. Who was that? She wrote the book, So You Want to Talk About Race. And in that book, she accuses all white people of being racist, and irredeemably so. She says this. It appears in my newest book that's coming out next month called DEI Exposed. And it's all clear that she's their keynote speaker. She is the avatar of this message. I don't know what, you know, it's one of those things where I don't know what else I could do. People say, well, you don't have any evidence. I said, well, excuse me. Here's the testimony. Here's the written testimony of the people doing it. You know, it's not me. It's you are, you know, you are saying that the BS and lies are coming from the people who are actually doing it. They're not only telling you what they're going to do, they tell you in their articles how well they did it in their after action reports. It's absolutely amazing the amount of material they have that's out there that is not that, and people succumb to the Maskarovka, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just teaching about race. It's just teaching about slavery. Well, no, it's not. No, it's not that at all. Amazing.
When that book comes out, make sure I get a copy, and we'll schedule an interview. And I'll do what I did with this one, which is read it all the way through.
Well, it sounds good. We're accelerating, uber accelerating the publication because of the timeliness of the topic. It'll be coming out very, very, very soon. And I look forward to seeing you on the show again with that book as well.
Yeah, it would be good. I think the audience would benefit from it greatly. 520-790-2040 if you want to call in and ask any questions. This portion of today's program is brought to you by Tucson Coin and Autograph. They do a beautiful job with autographs and coins and signgraphia, which is the study of bills and printed currency. And they're located at the corner of Oracle and Orange Grove at 6350 North Orange Grove on the southeast corner. And their phone number is 219-4427. That's 219-4427 or TucsonCoinAndAutograph.com. And back to the program. Let's see. We got about 3 minutes before the next break. How do we fix this? Let's invest the rest of the program in talking about the solutions. Go.
Well, I'll tell you, when I wrote the book, the solutions looked pretty distant. But I am so encouraged and optimistic with the executive orders signed by President Trump this past week, which really sets the stage for the battle to come. Believe me, this is not going to be a mopping up operation. These people are well-heeled. They are well-compensated. Let me give you an example. When I talk about DEI on the campuses, you're talking about, say, University of Virginia as an example. The top two DEI people, the chancellors or provosts, they both receive over $500,000. It's a more than $1 million in salary and benefits to the top two DEI persons. Now, those people are not going to go quietly. This is a lucrative con game that they're playing. They managed to fool college educators, fool administrators by saying, look, you're guilty of white complicity and white privilege, but we can give you absolution by paying us to run your DEI program. Now, I am very encouraged in the sense that students can take action at the individual level. We don't have to wait for any type of long-term reform. Students can take that kind of action on their own by challenging these co-curricular people, by demanding an informed consent form for brave spaces, racial caucuses, courageous conversations when they go in there saying, listen, I don't have to be here. I don't have to listen to you. You give me an informed consent form to sign. I'm not going to sign it, and I'm out of here. So, in other words, parents as well. I encourage parents to become involved in what their students are hearing and what they're seeing, because student affairs people hate this. They hate involved parents. They even advise parents with a smile on their face. No, you need to let Johnny or Mary Sue get socialized to the college environment, so it'll be best if you don't call them or talk to them in the first couple of weeks. Well, this is whenever they want to perform the brainwash, get that whole three-stage brainwash going in the first couple of weeks.
If they told me that, I'd be sitting in the back of the auditorium taking notes.
Mm-hmm,
my kids.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So the fact is that they don't want parents involved, and they don't want donors involved. They want donors, parents, to believe that the university is the way it always was. And that way the money will continue to flow, the tuition dollars will continue to flow. In fact, the university has changed radically, and I mean that quite literally. And so donors, I think that the people like Bill Ackerman, who pulled his money from Penn, who pulled his, and a number of other donors who pull their money from Harvard, from Penn, from Columbia, because of the unrest on the college campus that was run, that was kind of engineered by the left, basically expose them for who they are and what they are. And I think donor action is going to be more than adequate to help us turn that tide. But parents need to become involved. Become that helicopter parent. Find out what's going on the college campus. Talk about legal action if necessary when you're talking to these people. These are not the brightest people. They're just well-trained, the people on the campuses. They're well-trained in what they do. I'm not referring to the faculty. I'm referring to the student affairs people. As I said, they're basically folks who have a master's degree in education, and that's their big chit. And they want to be faculty. They want to be college educators, and they want to be educators on the
team. They want to make a difference.
Yeah, they've got all of those bromides. Diversity is our strength. Competence is our strength. Our strength, okay? Yeah. Wealth building is our strength.
Yeah.
Innovation is our strength.
Yeah. Prosperity is our strength. How about that?
Prosperity is our strength.
All right. Commercial breaks are our strength. Hang on for a moment. We got one coming up in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, 520-790-2040.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen.
Dawn Wells, is there anything you missed on the island?
Oh, well, actually, what I really missed, there we were with nothing to do. What I missed most was the Swap Shop. I mean, what fun we'd have had. I don't know how we'd have gotten a hold of you, but we'd have tried.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Hi, Mark Levin here. America Armed and Free. Sounds like a good title for a book. Congratulations on 20 years on KVOI, Charles.
Nothing kills human incentive like socialism. No one works hard, no one's invented with socialism. You can talk all you want about helping the poor. Capitalism does a better job for sure. The left is the problem, freedom is the cure. Say no to socialism, socialism.
A song that I doubt that Professor Stanley Ridgely will disagree with, and the sentiment therein. And that's, excuse me a second. That's Kathleen Stewart is the artist on that, and we have caller Jeff on the line. Jeff, go ahead. You're on with Dr. Stanley Ridgely. Go ahead.
Dr. Ridgely, it's a pleasure to be able to speak with you. I've experienced DEI culture 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago, at one of the universities in Arizona, and a second time at a different one. The first time was a courtship and marriage course, and she made a pregnant lady with an engagement ring cry, and basically saying, you know, marriage and courtship and childbirth are unnatural, and she was trying to put forth an agenda. Second time was a professor in a graduate school that got me to take a DEI course taught by a lady who lived in California who was a Stanford graduate. And one of my other professors professed to be a devout communist. But I finished that course at home. It was totally unrelated to political science. But one of the DEI courses I was forced to take was like a literacy requirement. It's only offered 2 years. Mm-hmm. I better take it so that I could graduate on time was the premise. But I was forced to comment on all kinds of really avant-garde, alternative lifestyle type things in the news. And I just wasn't interested. So I got a D in the course. I'd love to get it stricken from my record. I'm not looking for monetary compensation or to make it nationally known. But is there any recourse as to anything I could do? You know, I'm worried about getting called back up into the military for, you know, future needs, and I'm going to look like what they're trying to put out now, and I'm not that way. So,
good question, Stan.
So this is in the administrative realm, and I'm in the faculty realm. What you should do is basically start with what they prescribe, ask, you know, find out if you can have it expunged. And if they say, yeah, then you've succeeded. If they say no, then continue the conversation and begin taking it up the line and put pressure on them. For the most part, I have found that a lot of these folks, and I don't get much trouble on the campus, I'll tell you the truth, because they know that if you're a troublemaker or someone who's not going to quit, they'll find out that you make yourself more trouble than you're worth. And they'll say, okay, we're just going to go ahead and we're going to go ahead and quietly do this and get this guy off our back. That would be my – be the squeaky wheel that gets the grease. I'm not a person who – I'm not a person who believes in, you know, pulling out the big guns for every issue that comes down the pipe. If I can get it done through the system, then I will do it.
Tell them you just want a present that's unburdened by the past.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your issue there, and I understand. Thank you for your service, and
sure.
And I wish you luck on this.
All right, that do it, Jeff.
There's a caveat, real quick. I used the GI Bill, so if I got that course dropped, I would be dropped down to less than full time status. The bill's already been paid. I don't think the GI Bill people will come after me, unless the university tries to complicate it. In which case, then that's a whole different can of worms. But I don't know what to
you
do.
Let me just interject, just to say, just take another course and let that replace it. That's just kind of a common sense kind of thing. Just replace it with another course. I know you may not find that enjoyable, but you may.
All right, Jeff, appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And it opens up a line for you in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios at 520-790-2040. That was a very good question. One of the things, in fact, the first thing you suggest is cut off all university ties with colonized non-academic organizations and professional clubs, particularly ACPA and NASPA. That seems like it might be harder to do than just writing.
I tell you, it was when I suggested it when the book came out, it was seemed like very hard to do. Right now, I think you'll find that our robust state legislatures, empowered by our president and empowered by the demand that universities follow civil rights laws, U.S. civil rights laws, and the Constitution, the First Amendment, and the 14th Amendment. I think you're going to find that has a lot of muscle. You're going to have preemptive compliance. A lot of universities right now, and have been for the last couple of months in anticipation of the inauguration of President Trump, have been quietly moving in
shelving.
The direction that will keep them out of trouble. Yes.
Yeah, shelving.
The Harvard and a number of other universities have settled lawsuits with Jewish students who were suing them for their lack of protection on the campuses in the previous year. I think we know what we're talking about.
Yep.
Basically the assault, the threats, the blocking of the campuses, and the threatens to a particular constituency on the campus and the university's lack of action. And they've been settling these lawsuits one after the other. Harvard just settled theirs the day after Trump's inauguration. It's phenomenal what's going on here. So I think you're going to find that there's all it's going to take is someone to bring the subject up with regard to, say, the University of Texas, the University of Iowa. Say, hey, why are we permitting these ideologically grounded organizations to train the people who work for us in this illegal activity, basically the kind of activity that is prohibited by the executive orders.
Right.
And all it's going to take is having people call there to testify, to start asking the right questions, because right now that's not even on the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Getting it on the agenda for discussion is task number one.
You know, it strikes me that of all people to screw with, young Jewish Harvard law students would be very low on the list.
Yeah. Or they would be the most vulnerable, you know?
They would be what? Say that again.
Vulnerable. Vulnerable in the sense that, hey, we're going to go after a vulnerable target here. Someone who is folks that are not usually politically active in terms of making demonstrations and who are – we're going to attack them in isolation. I will tell you, the day after the attacks on October 7th, the following Monday, I went down by the Hillel the Hillel office here at my university. I asked, I talked to the rabbi, and I said, there's some people here who support you a great deal. And would it be okay if I shared the burden of threat on our campus quite publicly by wearing a yarmulke, a kippah? I'm not Jewish, but I'm more than happy to wear that to share the burden of threat with, rather than simply saying right. behind the
Spread
scenes,
the
hey,
risk.
I support you.
Spread the risk.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I did that, and so I began doing that. And they gave me a couple of Israeli flags, one of which is on my door, along with the U.S. flag, and also along with a poster of kidnapped kids on my door. So I see no reason to – I don't go around – I don't ever proselytize people in the hallway or anywhere, for that matter, certainly not in class. But I certainly have no – I behave as if this was, I was in a rugby club or something, and I'm, putting a rugby flag on my door. I'll do what I want. And I'll exercise that freedom of speech that we all right. cherish on the college campuses.
Right. And if you proselytize too much, they accuse you of being a prostitute. All right, stand by in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios. We'll be right back with Professor Stan Ridgely after this.
Welcome to Monoral Radio, where we sing in black and white.
Right of the people to be secure in their places from warrantless raiders with masks on their faces means little or nothing without threat of force. Without the second, what good is the fourth?
Yeah, welcome back to the closing segments of America Armed and Free. I wrote that song, Stan. Hold on. I wrote that song, and it's the best line I ever put on paper. And I did write it on paper. And
well, that's a reason for celebration. I know that my wife appreciates that. She's listening right now. Her name, Lori is my number one editor, my number one supporter, and co-researcher. So
cool.
A shout-out to Lori.
Very cool. I love it. Some pauses here while I cough. But so other things you talk about doing in order to fix the problem of, in effect, mm-hmm. DEI on campus is ban Star Chamber judicial proceedings that put students on trial in ways that violate constitutional rights. There are procedures in colleges that don't allow students to be represented by an attorney. How do they get away with that?
Well, they're private colleges, and I have wondered that myself. And I've done research on this, and have seen the statement that protections against freedom of speech do not exist at private colleges that can run their operations how they see fit. Now, I think that is
if they take
right
federal dollars. Wait a minute, if they take federal dollars, they are subject to it.
Exactly. Then that's what the executive order on January 21st says, that universities are not just they're not federal contractors. They're federal subcontractors. They take research grants. They take students who are coming to college with their federal loans, federal guaranteed loans. And as a result, then this extends the federal government's mandate. Into the province of the privately run college. And so all it's going to take is one person. Well, students tend to do what they're told. You know, you are going to go in here. You can't have any representation, even if they ask for it. And they say, oh, okay, I'll just do it. They don't recognize that it's not a benign situation.
No.
It's a situation that could really have ramifications for their future. And this is why, as I said, one of my students said, look, my dad has said, if I get called into one of these star chambers, let him know. And he says, I'll have a lawyer down there lickety-split.
I wonder what would happen if you brought a lawyer when they said one wasn't allowed. I wonder what if they would not refuse to hear the...
You mean recording the entire encounter as well? I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
I think the only way you're going to get these things changed, and you won't get them changed simply by going through the system and say, well, we need to change this. What causes change is confrontation. The left has known this for quite some time, and I think that the right needs to learn this. And I'm not talking about confrontation for confrontation's sake. I'm not that kind of person. I'm talking about confrontation when a great injustice is about to be done, and a line needs to be drawn in the sand, a stake put in there, and the fact is that say, you're not going to do this to me. I'm not going to allow it.
Well,
and we're going to publicize this.
The thing we need to do is sue professors individually, as opposed to suing them under the umbrella, then figure out that they are acting outside the scope. And when, if law enforcement does this, they call it doing things under the color of law. Hang on a second.
Yeah, well, I agree with you 100%. Again, I want to caution your listeners that it's really because the these student affairs people on the campuses have been hiding behind faculty for a long, long time. And the natural response for people to say, we're going to go after the faculty. Well, the faculty are a very small part of the problem. The real problem is this bloated administration, the bloated deans and deanlets and provosts and all of the little enrollment managers and residence hall advisors that have been hired over time to bloat this student affairs bureaucracy. They're the ones that need to be sued. They're the ones that need to be gone after. Those are the ones who hide behind anonymity. And they love to quote policy. They love to cite policy in everything they do. And all it's going to take is a student or students to bring that to the attention of the right kinds of lawyers, and you're going to find universities probably beginning to modify how they deal with students. Again, universities are protected by insurance, and that's what insurance companies need to understand is that they put themselves at risk, their financial solvency at risk, by insuring universities that have shown irresponsibility.
It seems to me that a group like the ACRU or the American Law Alliance or other organizations that work for that are nonprofit public interest law firms, that this would be ripe for them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you've got Alliance Defending Freedom. You have Speech First.
Right.
The American Council of Trustees and Alumni. I don't want to leave anyone out. You even got Turning Point, which is a student organization. I should say that I'm the faculty advisor for the Turning Point chapter at Drexel. Mm-hmm. And
where is Drexel?
Great
located?
Students. Drexel's right here in Philadelphia, on Market Street, right next to. And when I say this, I mean literally next to the University of Pennsylvania. Hmm. They're across the street from us, literally across the street. We're a vibrant Research One university with 25,000 students and a noted STEM school.
Hmm.
I urge everyone to consider it for engineering and for chemistry and for math and computers. We're fabulous.
What's their campus policy on if you have a concealed weapons permit?
I can't really answer that question. Don't want to go there. I don't think that that's – I would think that would be frowned upon. That's just my guess. I don't think that's something that the university really – probably the similar to many other universities. That would be my guess.
They've been trying for a number of years in Arizona to make it so that if you have a CCW, you can carry on campus if you're a student. I don't know. It's certainly not going to go through former Secretary of State Hobbs, who I refuse to call governor. Anyway, I digress. Other things we could do about this besides suing people, elimination or transfer of higher education graduate programs, educational leadership, higher education administration to the School of Business Administration or some other rigorous college that is not colonized and tainted with racialism. How would you go about doing that?
Well, that's going to have to be an initiative from the faculty and certainly from the bureaucracy. Undergoing administrative realignments or restructuring and moving departments hither and yon is a very complex and convoluted process. And the folks who don't want that to happen, they have all kinds of ways of putting sticks in the spokes to prevent that, the gears from turning. I'm blue skying it right there because I think that there's opportunity probably in places where universities or colleges that say, hey, you know what, that's a good idea. We're ripe for that. And then you get the senior management, the senior leadership, the senior administrators saying, this is what we're going to do. And you can either get aboard or, get off the train. And that's how you can make that sort of thing happen. But believe me, the bureaucracy being what it is, and it's called bureaucracy for a reason and red tape for a reason, quite literally, I think, red tape in this case. You've got the commies and the pink fringe trying to stop any kind of reform, say, of President Trump's justice agenda. I like to call it a justice agenda, getting rid of these DEI programs, diversity programs, and restoring American higher education to its enlightenment roots. It's going to be very tough. And so you're going to have a champion at in the senior leadership. This is a people-driven issue because you can change the policy like we've seen going on right now. You can change a policy. You can change the label. But unless you are willing to change these committed ideologues and get rid of them, and I don't mean send them through to be retrained. That's not going to work. I mean get rid of them. I mean move them out of the university. Refresh the organization, as we like to say in business. Refresh the organization with the right kinds of folks who understand American civics, understand American, the U.S. Constitution, and the rights that are guaranteed under that Constitution. Bingo, we want that person working for us. You know? Unless you can do that, it's going to be very difficult. Not impossible.
Boy, it's a good thing for them that our side doesn't have gulags.
Oh, well, that's what they think that's going to happen. That's what I've actually had friends of mine say that people like me, they're going to come after me under Trump administration. I said, my goodness, guy, if they come after you, I'll whisper a word in the right people. I'll stand in their way, okay? But no one's going to come after you. It's utter nonsense.
Right.
But there's kind of histrionics and
there's
they
a fella,
go into.
There's a fella here in the building that he says, boy, when I look at Trump, all I see is, and then he does the Nazi salute. And, you know, my response is...
I've seen that kind of thing, too.
Yeah.
Actually.
And my response has always been, boy, you're very good at that.
You're a natural.
You got the gesture down perfectly, you know? I mean...
You're a natural. You were born to the salute.
Yeah. I grew up watching that, you know, at B'nai Jacob. Films about that. I said, you do just a really good impression, you know? He's even got the narrow mustache. I mean, we're halfway there. anyway, that's neither here nor there. So how do you instill transparency in the institution?
Well, in my opinion on that issue, it has to be some sort of stimulating event, some sort of seismic event that's going to get rid of everyone's attention. Because if it's business as usual, no one's going to engage in behavior other than what they're doing already. They're engaging in the behavior they're engaging in now because they're very comfortable with it. And if someone says, you know what, we need you to change your behavior in ways that are going to make your actions more transparent, do you think they're going to be receptive to that? No. But in a situation where the university is under threat, as it is now, and I'm referring to economic threat in the sense that enrollment threat, financial threat, where people's jobs are on the line, where they might have to justify what it is they do, I think that that's going to rivet minds wonderfully. And you'll see cries for more transparency when they're coming from the senior leadership to the people down below them, as opposed to, say, someone like me who's, you know, looking laterally saying, you know, we need to be more transparent, you know, getting a, transparency is great. I think that we'll see some action given the fact that the universities are going through a kind of a joint crisis. They like to say we're facing headwinds, and that's headwinds of enrollment, of financial. You've got Trump threatening to tax the endowments of major universities 35%, which is long overdue. He's got the feds saying we're going to pull your funding perhaps if you don't adhere to U.S. law,
right.
Civil rights law. That's going to concentrate their minds wonderfully, and suddenly the leadership is going to say, hey, I need to know what you're doing in the DEI office, and I need to know if you're going to get us in trouble. That's what gets the transparency.
There's an old saying from the 60s, when you have them by the genitals, their hearts and minds will follow. All right, stand by. Last break coming up in the Wilkinson Wealth Management Studios, back after these messages.
Swap Shop trains are coming, rolling down that free market track.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop. Let's listen. This is Caroline.
Happy Chickens.
We have a 5-acre horse property for sale.
They're participating in the program.
Please make that part of the package.
A ranch with chickens. They might call that the chicken ranch.
I've been called worse.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch. Imagine that this is your daughter.
What do you want?
Now you get to decide how this scene ends. Or...
Stop, Earl! Stop! Stop!
Some misinformed people want to take away your daughter's choice between rape and self-defense. We're pro-choice on self-defense. Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership, JPFO.org.
It ain't your money to spend. You're acting like a bunch of jerks. I'm the one who earned it. I'm the one who works. Your income redistribution doesn't jive with the Constitution. So I got a little message to send. It ain't your money to spend.
And welcome back to the last segment of America Armed and Free with Professor Stan Ridgely. The book is Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities, and it's very good. It's worth reading and actually studying. Where do you want people to get the book, Stan?
Well, Brutal Minds is available on Amazon, and I say Amazon first because they offer all three popular formats, a hardcover, the Audible version. You can listen to that. You can listen to me for 7.5 hours, talk, reading from the volume. And they also offer Kindle. I've heard that all three, that it's important to acquire all three versions to really get the flavor of Brutal Minds. That's a jest, of course.
It is different listening than reading.
Website.
What?
Yeah, it certainly is. I don't like the sound of my own voice, which is the case with a lot of people, but I've heard good things about the Audible version.
All right.
And I had fun doing that. And I would also say you can go to my website, brutalminds.com, and sample some of my other writings that published after I published this book, and you can also order the book there as well. But, yeah, brutalminds.com, you can get that on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you suggest doing is subject schools of education to rigorous outside audit to ascertain the state of play and of student selectivity, program diversity, and openness, degree of ideological colonization, and rigor of academic standards of research. Is there a mechanism in most universities today to do that?
Well, we have auditing. Well, I say auditing. I mean the accreditation groups that come through to accredit. We just had an accreditation crew come through at the business school, and that there are other accreditation groups that come through and do the same thing for education schools. Well, that's a problem because the folks who are doing the accrediting are part of the problem themselves. Because education schools were colonized at least 2 decades ago. And when I say colonized, I'm talking about the complete takeover by critical theory and critical race theory and the critical theory of a fellow by the name of Paulo Freire,
right?
Who was a crypto-Maoist. He was a Maoist and even said so. He really admired Mao and basically took all his education theories, cribbed them from Mao Zedong.
Mm-hmm.
And his book, 1970s, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is the third most cited book in social sciences. But he's really just a neo-Marxist, neo-Maoist lout. He is revered in education schools. He's revered because he's not Marx. They can say Paulo Freire and get away with it because no one's going to say, oh, wait a minute, your top theorist is Karl Marx or your top theorist is Mao Zedong. You can't say that, but you can say, oh, Paulo, third world, Paulo Freire, got a gray beard, kind of a kindly visage, like a kindly uncle. Well, the matter is he was a crypto-Maoist. And
looks a lot like Karl Marx.
Schools. I'm sorry?
Looks a lot like Karl Marx.
Well, he does, yeah. He's and I think that there's no accident there. He was buddies with Che Guevara. He admired Fidel Castro. He said this now, I quote, he said that Mao's cultural revolution was the most genial solution of the century, meaning in terms of re-educating the people, in terms of forcing them to come to the light of critical consciousness. He said this in 1974 when the Cultural Revolution's atrocities were well known. And so this is, a lot of people who admire Paulo Freire have no idea that he is like this. They have a kind of a superficial, skin deep understanding of Paulo Freire. They just know he's Brazilian, that you haven't heard of him. And because of that, it gives them a sense of, quasi sense of superiority because they know of Paulo Freire. He's a lout. He was a buffoon.
When I type in Paulo Freire, the first thing that comes up, Google fills in the blank with Freedom School.
Well, he is revered amongst education school people. And that's what I mean by going to education schools and ensuring that they're getting the full range of pedagogical sources of how to teach, and not simply the doctrine of a doctrinaire foreigner, Brazilian. He's Brazilian, which is really warmed over Marxism, warmed over Maoism. That needs to be, at the very least, it needs to be trumpeted as that here's what we're doing and here's why we're doing it. And here are some of the writings of Paulo Freire that, you otherwise wouldn't see, which shows his Marxism, Maoism. And I think that would be a giant step in the right direction.
Has anyone done an expose on him? Has anyone written a good book on that? Hint, hint.
Well, I can tell you that Chris Rufo, his book, America's Cultural Revolution, has a nice section on Paulo Freire, a very nice section on it. I have a little section in my own book, Brutal Minds, on Paulo Freire. I highly recommend Chris Rufo's book with respect to that. But other than that, and there's another one, I can't think of the name of it right now. I think it's Paulo Freire and his Cold War Marxism. But I cannot think of the author right now. That book is at my office. Otherwise I'd give it to you. Paulo Freire is an interesting character. You can do some research. I think his book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, is cited. But I tell you, most people probably don't read it. I've read it. It's boring. It is not imaginative. It is not fresh, new, and different. It's really warmed over Maoism. And if you're familiar with Mao's education policy,
reading John Maynard Keynes.
Oh, he said, the greatest economist of the 20th century. That's absurd.
What
I think
nonsense.
Hayek is the greatest.
It's clear, and when you read Hayek, you feel uplifted by it. When you read John Maynard Keynes, all you feel is confused. I talked to Professor Butch Browning of Texas A&M, who's head of their economics department, and I said, why is it that – I said, I don't think I'm smart enough for this. He goes – this must be post-doctoral level work because it's going completely over my head. And he goes, yeah, Charles, it goes over mine too. And he's like, he goes, that's because it's not – he says, it ain't you. It's because it's not understandable.
Believe me, opacity in the academic world is not something that – it's something it's driven for, so people don't realize that you're passing bullshit, BS, I should say. So, John Maynard Keynes is responsible for priming the pump and deficit spending, the idea that you can smooth out the oscillations and, the booms and busts of the economy. Whereas Hayek, I think, is far more attuned to the way people really behave with respect to commodities and buying and selling and supply and demand. I mean, Hayek is absolutely required reading. The Road to Serfdom, of course, is required reading. I gave my wife, she's a wonderful woman, I gave her a third edition hardback of Road to Serfdom. I said, best I could afford is dust jacket. It's proudly up on our mantle there. She loved it.
Yeah. Smart women always do love books. First thing I gave my ex-wife back in the day in the 70s was a book, and we had fun reading it together and talking on the phone. So.
Well, my wife's also a big fan of Milton Friedman, sure, you are as well.
Yes.
And Thomas Sowell, of course.
Of course. And, boy, when you quote Thomas Sowell to somebody, and they go, where are you getting this? And, you know, you tell them Thomas Sowell, and they say, that's racist. Clearly. You know.
Well, you know,
they used to call Walter Williams the black face of white, what do you call it?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Of white, white privilege. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew Walter. Actually, the late Walter was a great guy. I introduced him to Sapporo. It's Japanese beer. I had him at conferences. It's been 30 years. He was great. He was an absolute gentleman and a brilliant economist. Just
I wrote to him once. He wrote me back. Didn't know who I was. All right, we're in the theme music. Stan Ridgely, I got to let you go, but the book is Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities. Appreciate your time.
Charles, I thank you for the opportunity, and good luck and God bless.
You too. I want to encourage you all to be vigorous, not violent, vigilant, not vituperative. In Liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
Truth, lead us on to victory. Victory.
AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson.
We will raise high our banner with freedom as our song. May the fire of liberty keep burning in me. Stand tall for what is right, and what we see is not our fight. Let grace and truth lead us on to victory. Let grace and truth lead us on to victory. Let grace and truth lead us on to victory.
AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. This portion of today's program has been brought to us by Safe Shift at 2801 East Grant Road. Great bargains, great store, great people.